Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by award-winning Irish poet Desmond Egan, founder of the Goldsmith Press in 1972, and founder and artistic director of the Gerard Manley Hopkins Festival in 1987. The title of his presentation will be An Evening of Irish Poetry. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, March 13, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Kelly Keller, the director of the Center for Faith Studies.
Without further ado, I'm going to introduce our guest speaker, Desmond Egan. As you can see in your program, he was born in Ireland in 1936, and if you're doing your math, that puts him in the octogenarian category, almost. So he's in that club, the New 60, I understand. He founded the Goldsmith Press, and as of today, has published 23 collections of poetry. Has that number changed? 23? 24, see? He's still at it. His poem Peace was adopted as a celebration of peace for the millennium and was translated into 35 different languages. I can't even come up with 35 different languages. He founded the Gerard Manley Hopkins Festival in 1987 and continues as the artistic director. He has been awarded the U.S. National Poetry Award for his collected poems. And I understand you got to meet Liam Neeson as part of your getting an award for poetry in Chicago and reading at an event that Liam Neeson was also being honored at. So for those of us that know movie stars better than poets, maybe that's a doorway. One thing, as I was reading the literary review for you, Des, I was struck by how pervasive the call to peace, to even if it's elusive, as it was for so long in Northern Ireland, that is no excuse for us not to continue to work for it. And that really drew me in. And I think in times where we're thinking that it's just too hard, it's good to remember that we've been in those times before. And we can come out on the other end. So very grateful that you're bringing your voice and your wisdom tonight. So without further ado, would you please help me welcome Desmond Egan.
Thank you very much for such a warm welcome. It's good to be here, and it's a privilege, which I'm aware of. And it's doubly good to be here in St. Patrick's Week. As you know, St. Patrick was pretty much of an Irishman. And now he's the only one, I think, the only saint who's commemorated in every country in the world. One of the reasons being, by the way, the part of his genius was he promoted women. And one of the patron saints of Ireland is St. Bridget. And Patrick, at a time when it wasn't very obvious or common to do, he saw the genius of women and gave them their chance as well as he did his own followers. So, if you're up there, Patrick, well done. The first poem I'd like to read for you tonight is a favourite of my own. It's very simple. And it has to do with finding a photograph in the back of a drawer some years later, and everything in the photograph has become charged and even symbolic, and is a reminder to us that we might get lost in the detail of life, and still there's something deeper and permanent at the back of us all. I chanced on a photo. My father in short sleeves, standing by the greenhouse on so relaxed a summer's day, no one bothered to pose, not even the dandelions. And my mother saying something to Kate, who wonders with the yellow roses. The privet hedge we cut down since looks lovely. A doll lies forever in the sun, and I can almost smell the dinner, see our folding chairs and table, the other side of my camera. The red serviettes glowing. Serviettes, we call them, you call them napkins. We reserve that for babies and napkins. Next poem I'd like to read for you is from a collection I wrote about a very beautiful part of Ireland. I'm sure some of you have been there, down in Kerry. Anyone here visited Kerry? I knew there would be some. I'm not so sure about the poems, are they good enough, but the photographs are superb in this book. That's always my fear too. I've been translated a lot, 25 books of translation actually, and I always feel when I hear the translation being read that the translations are better than the originals. There's a line in this from the great Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa, absolutely wonderful poet, died in the early part of the 20th century from Lisbon. And the line is, "Papel rascado de intento." And in case your Portuguese is a little bit rusty, it means the torn up or scringed up page of an attempt to write a poem. I have myself thrown my life into the waste paper basket. Writing a poem is very demanding and mostly meets with failure. This is epilogue. Out the window of my study, papel rascado de intento, a leaden March morning gives, and blue tatters show. There's a crow gawking from a bare tree, a volley from an unseeable blackbird. And for no reason, I remember Kerry, the long road of stillness, on Yohannock shivering with daylight, the perspective to the sisters' mountains, mist heights, a view of abandoned ocean, somebody's voice coming a long way, life draining from a hill, landscape of tragic faces where time fades to eternity, that great grey movement over us all. I'm very fond of music, different kinds of music, including classical. And I wrote a book called Music. One of the impulses behind it was becoming friendly with one of the great pianists of our time, the Swedish pianist Hans Paulsen. If you haven't got any of his CDs, rush out. He changed my life. He will change yours. He goes down into the music and discovers in it the meaning of nearly everything. This is from a sequence. I'll just read one poem. Stool adjusted, as if tuned. You meditate yourself together, ready for the journey. And in quick intimacy, offer your hands poised to the keyboard. Allow it to draw you elsewhere in discovering the Schubert impromptu. An authority I recognize, an immediate wholeness, throwing open the music so that the struck sounds begin to cluster in arpeggios of the human into a mood, one resonant chord, an intake in the pure space between notes, an awareness, a passion, a yes, a being. My God, wonderful. And window, walls, roof, fall off, sheer off, and we are away and elsewhere, out in the wideness of the universe, with all that passes and does not pass. And your playing is no longer playing, but a recognizing, a cry, an elegy for everyone, for your mute audience, impermanent, lasting as the melody, its poise and doubt, a stretching in fingers, arms, a dying in being born, the adagio in living. As this murmur between two hands grows to its own dimension, weigh the far side of words. Something elemental, vague shapes on our cave. A feeling, a completeness of feeling, a voice in the hall. And of course, I love Irish music. And I try, in something I wrote about it, to catch at the Celtic spirit which is behind it. The Irish, as you know, are Celts. And our language is a Celtic language. When you're in Ireland, you will go to see the Book of Kells. And you will be struck by the formality and stylistic strictness of it. And also, if you look carefully, at an impishness, a tendency to extemporize, maybe a cat chasing a mouse across a letter, or a dog sitting waiting for a hare to peep out. That kind of whimsicality and that kind of inventiveness. And that same spirit is in Irish music, as is the spirit behind Irish dance. which, unlike river dance, which you may have heard, is not hands all up or over the place. That's not pure Irish music. The real thing, the hands are by the side. And within that, if you get a good dancer, you can get an amazing expression of moods. So that the formality and strictness make possible a different kind of expression. Without it, hands all over the place, it's like playing tennis without the net. I mention the word bowron here. Bowron is an Irish word, and it's a drum made from goat skin. In the hands of a good player, it's an addition. But many bowron players are insensitive louts, and they come in and bang, boom, dum, boom, dum, and that's the end of the music. You can hear nothing. So there is permanent enmity between the musicians and the bowron players. And one musician, famous musician, Seamus Ennis, was asked, what's the best way to play a bowron? And he said, with a knife. A lot of Irish music takes place in pubs, which suit the spontaneity of it and the inventiveness of it. Bar session. And now he is fiddling so fiercely that the bow barely moves, raised, lowered, to the flicker of fingers, of feeling, a skid on strings. As the strict reel, the improvised slides, grace notes, delays, double stops, all rev together into wilder life, even imaged in a grin he throws at his accordion player, pumping away in tandem and smiling back in that Gaelic code of ease under pressure. His thumb in place like a tradition, his fingers tapping buttons like mad. This touch and release. Those straight arms in our dance. That line, sure as a letter in the Book of Kells itself, still allows like it for the whimsical. Although a bowron player would know he should go almost unnoticed. Oh, it's all so Irish. No other musician can quite get it. It strikes no chords, no attitudes. Half a glance together and they bridge tasty together into another tune, Over the Moor to Maggie. Put down your drink and listen. Next time, it will be different. And the third kind of music in this is American jazz, which has had a big influence on the way I write. I used to come over to New York to hear the great jazz musicians. I heard them all, met many of them, was invited to dinner by Duke Ellington. And I used to just go from one session to another. And I couldn't go back home from this outpouring of energy, this immediacy of response, this absolute contemporaneity, and start writing about flowers in a vase. So it changed completely my perception of what I should be doing. So as well as enjoying some of the great musicians, I also was the better of it as a writer. And one of the people whom I met, who actually spoke to me, and whom I admired enormously, was Thelonious Monk. many of you will know about. Meeting Thelonious, he played, as expected, in a hat, black hands splayed, beating his own sound from the piano, as if death were plucking the bass, driving the drums, and Monk had to get it all into his only music, to which at one stage he rose and shuffled in another indirection, in that strange dance he sometimes did. And something began to take shape before our very ears. Something so true, it made irrelevant our applause, which was barely acknowledged. Something which has stayed real enough to sustain me down the years with its weird beauty. Afterwards, he nodded kindly as Nellie, his wife, and I talked a little at the exit, turned to me, mumbled about a few who cared, repeated it, and waited for the word I still haven't got. That reminds me, I was in the jazz club and looking with my wife. She was tired and we were looking for a way out, and I saw a sign which said exit, and I began to move towards it, and it was the musician's exit, and there was a fellow in charge, and he said to me, "No man, you can't go out here. You can't use this exit." I said, "Look, I'm tired. I'm not looking for the meaning of life. I just want to go home." He said, "I hear you, man. On you go." Well, I grew up in a small town called Athlone. It's right in the middle. And we had, when we graduated from the convent school and were big fellas going up to the boys' school, national school, we had every year the habit of singing a song. "We got our holidays and we don't care." And we thought everyone did this. I found out afterwards nobody else did it. But it was a moment when you began to grow up, to become more responsible, I suppose. Leaving the convent school, around about noon, the escapees would burst in every direction from the one archway that fell behind, along with the nuns and sums and high roller blinds and black babies' boxes, out into the revolutionary streets, chanting in gangs, "We got our holidays and we don't care." Swinging by the straps, those useless school bags, over the soft tar of summer. And sometimes poetry can be accused of, and we can too, of being a bit negative. So the next poem I'd like to read for you is just called Habedank. It's the same, it means thank you. Thanks for what I have to be grateful for. Rooks wheel silent in the light through the green yellow valley of bushes where a diamond tingles. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for such unexpected, for the way our crazy Springer dog takes one look, tears off on his path and leaps the raspberries. And even for the flicker of a car through the leaves of a new day, thank you, Lord. Thank you for this drift of mist, its delicate light flecks on the glass, and for the miracle of all water, for that which glints between trees, lies deep at a cliff, or comes crashing in mountains, smashing our hesitations into plumes. Thank you, Lord. And for my little stretch of the River Liffey, comforting in shades and trees, its thought swans circling on the dark, bright surface. And no little for that music which goes beyond the here and now to where we can be loved and mourned. And for the someone special who brings us there, thank you for the few. For the friends, too, who without knowing help keep our laugh alive. Not forgetting the everyday ones, the tidy little woman in the paper shop, the man parading his greyhounds, the checkout girl who approves of your cheese. People who won't feature in the local papers. Ordinary folk who have found a way, fanning uptown towards a winter football match in the short coats and anoraks of detachment. Thank you for youngsters battling on their own where to go is to come back. For the ones chugging back to work on Monday. And thank you most for the valiant, the ones who make love, real. For those out bending in their garden, planting, weeding, digging at the future, who without ever guessing become my act of belief. Vielen Dank. Many thanks. I'll read. Does anyone like to ask a question? I don't bite, usually.
Yeah, there's the leaders of 1916, including De Valera, foresaw the opportunity for Ireland to reestablish its language and ancient culture. How do you think they would react today with Ireland being part of the European community? Would they foresee that you have lost the interest in restoring the Irish language and the culture of Ireland, the historical culture of Ireland? Have you traded off badly for that by affiliating with the European Union?
Again, you get two opinions. My opinion on that is that we haven't lost. Everyone knows we run the European Union. And the Irish language is making something of a comeback. Like all minority languages, it's under pressure. I wonder in, say, 25 years' time, will the whole world be speaking English? I travel the world a fair bit. And nearly everywhere I go, English is spoken. That is the kind of globalization even of language which is taking place. But at the same time, there are always pockets of resistance, and many of us love Irish too much to allow it to go down the Swanee. And I think the influence of the Irish language on the way in which we write English is not well adverted to at all. Irish is very concrete. English tends towards the abstract. If you ask yourself, why are so many Irish writers world famous? Samuel Beckett, James Joyce, W.B. Yeats, Sean O'Casey, Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw. Tell me when to stop. Why? For a small island. Do you know the population of Ireland today is, the whole lot, the 32 counties, is about 6.5 million people. Why has it had such an impact? And my belief is that it comes through the Irish language. Even if you don't know it, it knows you. It's there in the air. It's changed the perception of the way in which words are written. It makes the writing of English take on a certain kind of, you might say, poetic character. Very rooted, very concrete, and that's how poetry comes about. Because a thing has to be itself before it can take on any other symbolic implications. So I don't think the Irish language is in any danger at the moment at all. And in fact, the EU safeguards smaller languages, lesser languages. It sees, acknowledges their right, and there are certain grants and safeguards to it. And we have an Irish music television channel called Teleficion na Gaeilge, which has survived and done quite well. It was founded by our president, President Michael D. Higgins, and it's survived pretty well. Yes?
Did the Irish really save great learning and civilization during the Dark Ages?
For certain they did. Acknowledged by Newman, Cardinal Newman, in his famous essay, The Isles of the North. For an Englishman to recognize that the Irish saved civilization, because the hordes of invaders were coming across, right across Europe, as you know, and there was, libraries were being burnt, learned men killed, and so on. And there was danger even that literacy, the capacity to read, much less having anything to read, might even die out. It was the Dark Ages across Europe, the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. And in those times, people began to realise that the Irish monasteries back in Ireland were centres of amazing learning and had scholars and an influence which brought scholars from all over Europe over to Ireland. And there they learnt Latin, Greek, they learnt the art of calligraphy, Book of Kells, for example, around 800, and other magnificent examples of Irish manuscripts. The monasteries combined what W.B. Yeats always sought for himself. He sought for a place where religious, aesthetic, and practical life were one. He sailed to Byzantium to get an image of what he wanted. Had he been a bit more knowledgeable, he would have gone out to Clonmacnoise outside Athlone, where you had that, they were really genuine universities. And the standard of scholarship was amazing and acknowledged. And it was in this time that the whole major epic, European epic of Fionn Mac Cúil and the Fianna took place. And later, in the 18th century, a Scottish writer called Macpherson came over, discovered this wonderful and many-sided epic, brought it back, wrote a book called Oisín, O-S-I-A-N, which became an international bestseller. And had such, Goethe read it. Beethoven knew about it. Kings of Europe, scholars, everyone were taken by this and by the image in it of a hero, Fionn Mac Cool, and this heroic band and their great deeds and what they stood for and their whole story, everything that you would expect in an epic. And it has been said that the spread of this book and of the epic behind it was what ushered in the whole Romantic movement across Europe. Yes, the Irish did save civilization. Well, I'll just read two more poems, I suppose. And maybe finish up with a song, because the Irish are very fond of music. I'm going to read Envoy, because it brings together quite an amount of what I've been talking about this evening. Saying goodbye for the umpteenth time. The mind, like a pensioner, drifts on a favourite walk up the living road towards the bogs, which flood and colour everywhere. No doubt it could catch this side of the tidiness of that little village, Cornabool, those obvious moments along the Shannon. But that's a bit much just now. There being so little one can cope with. So I go up and up the same way in hope. As far as the Cross River, lean over the bridge and join the weeds, the ancient shadowings of water. Somewhere out there, like a hint of smoke on the breeze, Clonmacnoise, one of the monasteries I was talking about, rises in thought, a graveyard wide with unheard goodbyes. The sky goats are whinnying high, high in a summer evening, cutting sad, happy Celtic circles over our heads. The hedges have greened. I am walking very slowly, listening to my father. Well, I hadn't intended to read this, but now I think I will. It's a poem of mine which you mentioned in the run-in, which has become, I suppose, my best-known poem, and it's called Peace. It seems as relevant as ever in these tormented, uncertain times. Not only here, but everywhere. It struck me, I was asked to write this. Usually when I'm asked to write something, it doesn't work, because the minute you switch your mind to something, it becomes self-conscious and limited and rubbish. You have to be surprised by joy. This is the problem with trying to be a writer, trying to be an artist. Sometimes I think that breaking stones in the Wicklow Mountains is easier than writing a poem. Anyhow, I had a go at this, and it was in a collection, Poems for Peace, which had an introduction by Sean McBride, and I met him at the time. Many of you will know about Sean McBride. It struck me in writing it that peace is a very simple thing. Just a little walk. And yet, most of the world don't get that chance. Let us appreciate the simple things. Peace. Just to go for a walk out the road. Just that. Under the deep trees which whisper of peace. To break the bread of words with someone passing. Just that. Four of us round a pram and baby fingers asleep. Just to join the harmony, the fields, the blue everyday hills, the puddles of daylight, and you might hear a pheasant echo through the woods, or plover may waver by as the evening poises with a blackbird on its table of hedge. Just that, and here and there a gate, a bungalow's bright window, the smell of wood smoke, of lives. Just that. But sweet Christ, that is more than most of mankind can afford. With the globe still plaited in its own crown of thorns, too many starving eyes, too many ancient children squatting among flies, too many stockpiles of fear, too many dog jails, too many generals, too many under torture by the impotent, screaming into the air we breathe, too many dreams stuck in money jams, too many mountains of butter selfishness, too many poor drowning in the streets, too many shanty towns on the outskirts of life. Too many of us not sure what we want, so that we try to feed a habit for everything until the ego puppets, the militaries, mirror our own warring face. Too little peace. Thank you. Well, I thought I'd finish up with a song, if you have no objections.
Yeah. I have a question I should have asked you.
Okay.
Gerard Manley Hopkins Festival.
Oh, yeah. It's a celebration of the work of one of the greatest English poets. My favourite English poet is Gerard Manley Hopkins. He spent the last 6 years of his life in Dublin, where he died and is buried there. He died in 1889, born 1844. He was a member of the Anglican Church, who became a Catholic and then became a Jesuit. And he was brought over to Newman's University in Dublin, which later became University College Dublin. It was run by the Jesuits at the time, to teach Greek. He was a very fine Greek scholar. He was known as the Star of Balliol when he was in Oxford. And during that time, he travelled around a lot, but especially in the Irish Midlands. And we commemorate that. He passed through Newbridge. He visited various places in Kildare. He wrote poems in Clongowes Wood, where James Joyce was a student and wrote about in A Portrait of the Artist. And he had various friends and knew Dublin well and so on. So the connection of one of the greatest poets in English and one of the most influential with Ireland and with the Midlands was too important not to celebrate. And as well as being a great poet, Hopkins was also a musician. He composed quite an amount and was composed some music in Dublin. He was also the first conservationist. His poem, Binsey Poplars, is a poem to observe the rights of trees and of nature and to conserve what we have. And that was written about 1880. He was also an amazing naturalist. His notebooks are full of astonishing descriptions of nature. Early on in his life, he considered becoming a visual artist. And he was a man for all seasons, really. And we, in the Hopkins Festival, try to commemorate his many-sidedness, but especially, of course, his poetry. And we have lectures, we have poetry readings, art exhibition, two concerts, one of very fine Irish musicians, and one this year of Paulson, about whom I told you. He's coming to play this year. Okay, well, I'll finish up then with a song. I can either sing in Irish or English, whichever you would prefer. Well, I wrote the words of this myself in Irish and put them to an old Irish tune. And they have to do with the time when a nice girl was driving me slowly up the walls. The music is a famous Irish melody called An Ghrian Yas, which means the south wind. And I looked, it seemed to me that it was clearly music for words, but I never could find any words. So I said I'd solve the problem by writing some myself, and they had to be in Irish. And I knew that as soon as I had done it, that somebody would say, "Oh, but there are words to this." And so it happened. Anyhow, here are my words to An Ghrian Yas. An gréig séad ar mo hél man úr, an gréig neas lena djóra fúra. An júl an iscú pa omflín go brach, tam a húl go len húnach a quínú. O demig ma gar an nónach dú, I gasuad lig an slán gan fóg, hit fwishog ma gair e dost go djó, vrish an grín rog an gwi móge. Ma glanu an le a bánu shell, ach ma lloth na se spér, get you on my gal. Avon rian riagach mion chor mochri. O fill is na fog me mar nail sa gri. O dimig ma grair an nonach du, e gasuad li gan slan gan fog. Hit fwishog ma gair e dost go djó, frish an grín rog an gwi móige. Ma glanu an le a bánu shell, ach ma lloch nes a spér, get si wun ma gial. A van rian riagach, mion chara mochri. Oh. Shall I sing a song in English?
Shall he sing a song in English, he asks. I think we've got some agreement for that.
The song I sing in English was James Joyce's favorite. Some of you will know it. Once in the dear dead days beyond recall, when on the world the mist began to fall, out of the dreams that rose in happy throngs, lo, to our heart love sang its old sweet songs. And in the dusk where fell the firelight gleams, softly it wove itself into our dreams. Just a song at twilight, while the lights are low, and the flickering shadows softly come and go. Though the heart be weary, sad the day and long, still to us at twilight comes love's old song, comes love's old sweet song. Just a song at twilight, while the lights are low, and the flickering shadows softly come and go. Though the heart be weary, sad the day and long, still to us at twilight comes love's old song, comes love's old sweet song.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by award-winning Irish poet Desmond Egan, founder of the Goldsmith Press in 1972, and founder and artistic director of the Gerard Manley Hopkins Festival in 1987. The title of his presentation was An Evening of Irish Poetry. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday evening, March 13, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Kelly Keller, director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.